Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Tracking deer through infrared technology.
Any object basically gives off heat radiation.
Bluegrass musician Ricky Skaggs talks about his book, Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music.
I can tell these stories with conviction. I can tell them in ways that, that have, a weighty quality about it.
Kentucky poet laureate Frank X. Walker discusses his work as a writer and activist.
You know, whatever we bring to the page is a byproduct of who we are in the real world.
And meet the first Future Farmers of America national office holder from West Virginia in 40 years.
So I decided, you know what, I'm going to go into the rabbit business. I'm going to start selling these things and make millions of dollars.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. In Kentucky, there's a bourbon trail, and across Appalachia, there are wine regions and a resurgence of spirit making of all sorts. Moonshine, once the bane of tax collectors and the boon of scofflaws, is not only legal, but popular. Since Tennessee legalized the stuff in 2009, moonshine has been popping up in liquor stores and spawning a small but growing tourism industry. But what is it that makes moonshine, moonshine? WUOT's Christine Jessel went to the Tennessee Hill Country to find out.
Steve Bosch is a master distiller at Davy Crockett's Tennessee Whiskey in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. University of Tennessee Professor Emeritus Dr. Jamie Adcock has spent a lifetime studying chemistry. Together, they'll walk us through the process of making moonshine.
Kind of noisy in the background with the still going. Over here we have our 400-gallon cooker. That's where we cook the corn mash. We have to heat it up to 200 degrees. It releases all the starch out of the corn so we can convert it to sugar and the yeast can eat it and make alcohol.
The yeast begins to eat, in a sense, the carbohydrate or the sugar and convert it into energy. To get the energy it needs, it will generate heat and it will produce carbon dioxide and ethanol.
Ethanol is the product you want. That's the drinkable product. There's several different types of alcohol that are made during the fermentation process. Methanol, butanol, hexanol, propanol. The only good one you want is ethanol. I'm sure everybody's heard stories of people going blind from drinking moonshine, and that was the methanol.
And methanol can cause liver damage, can damage your retina, make you go blind, kill you. So unless a distiller, a moonshiner, is very careful, you can get a very bad product.
So, of course, when you first start the still, the strip and run, which is what we're doing right now, when you first start your strip and run, your methanol and your bad alcohols are going to be the first ones to come off the still. So you want to take the first, depending on your size, couple gallons maybe, and just discard it because it's not any good.
Moonshiners didn't have the blending. They didn't put it into charcoal barrels. They didn't age it to get a blend that had the flavor that makes it Jim Beam or Jack Daniels. And they just basically produced a clear, colorless liquid and sold that.
It's the same basic process that's been used for hundreds of years, but everybody has their own little quirks, their little processes they go through. And the small things make a big difference in the taste. How fast you distill it, how fast you cool the vapor down. Anytime you distill, it evaporates the alcohol, but it also carries across a certain amount of water and a certain amount of impurities.
You can't get pure ethanol by simple distillation. It comes out as a mixture with water.
That was one of the questions. I said, okay, well, it's an ethanol alcohol. And everybody's like, well, can you drive with it? And the answer, in short, is no.
Not directly. If you put hooch in your gas tank, you will have a problem.
Okay, so no Thunder Road with moonshine in the back.
A bottle of whiskey is not going to do you.
That was Davy Crockett's Tennessee Whiskey Master Distiller Steve Bosch and UT Chemistry Professor Emeritus Dr. Jamie Adcock. I'm Christine Jessel.
West Virginia has a lot of deer, and they can be a burden. For instance, the state's vehicle collision rate with deer is one of the highest in the nation, according to a study by State Farm Insurance. As West Virginia Public Radio's Ben Aduccio reports, new technology is being used to monitor these animals.
You see them while driving along the interstate. You'll catch them in your residential neighborhoods, eating vegetables from your garden. They're deer, and the state is trying to find better ways to quantify how many of them are in West Virginia. Sheldon Owen is a wildlife specialist at the West Virginia University Extension Office in Morgantown.
A lot of people will say that we have too many deer out there. But those individuals who really love to see a lot of deer are happy with the numbers. We're experiencing a lot of deer damage in the state to agriculture, to landscaping, to gardens, and also our natural resources, our forests and forest regeneration are really having an impact or taking a hit because of the number of deer foraging on the seedlings and things they're trying to grow.
This week, members of the Extension Office are canvassing Morgantown using new methods to track how many deer are in the city. This includes using a special infrared technology, Owen explains.
Any object basically gives off heat radiation or this sort of thermal signature. A forward-looking infrared or a thermal imaging device basically captures that information and translates it onto a screen so we can actually form a picture of what is going on out there. And so we can see this thermal picture or an actual looks like a video picture of what is across the landscape, so we can determine the outline of a deer.
Owen says the infrared technology is superior to the current system that utilizes spotlights.
In using spotlights, we are relying on this external light source. In some cases, we are missing deer because we can't see them through vegetation, or they're not looking at us and we're not getting that eye shine from the spotlight hitting their eyes. And we can underestimate the number of deer in an area. By using this technology of forward-looking infrared or thermal imaging, we can find up to 30% more of the deer, the animals that are out there.
The Extension Office works closely with the Division of Natural Resources on projects like this. Owen is hoping more counties will use this infrared technology so deer counts can be more accurate.
We're doing this to try to see or try to come up with a protocol that everyone can use. Right now, this is used in some areas around the nation. It is available, and we'll provide another tool to wildlife managers out there that they can implement and get a better handle on the number of animals that they are working with.
Even with the new system, Owen says there will be challenges. He says the biggest one may be line of sight, or in other words, finding deer that may be hidden behind buildings and in geographically tricky locations where it could be tough to find them. But he says infrared gives another advantage.
You're able to see through heavy fog, smoke, mist, and things. So it just gives us that ability to see animals out there or detect animals that are otherwise missed with some of our other technologies, such as just using a spotlight.
The locators will be traveling in vehicles to do the work. Once the information is collected, the Extension Office will pass along the numbers to the city of Morgantown, which allows urban deer hunting. Owen and his team also work with the Division of Natural Resources, so they will receive the more accurate numbers as well. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ben Aduccio in Morgantown.
For those of us who like to make up our own minds about who, what, and how we are, this is a strange country, where U.S. News and World Report, Time Magazine, and the Gallup poll profess to know more about our human condition than we do ourselves.
Essayist Michael Blumenthal.
According to those harbingers of happiness and taste, for example, I and my fellow West Virginians are now served by, and in my case teach at, the nation's 83rd best law school, up from 99th in a single year, and reside in its unhappiest, unhealthiest, and most obese state. Funny thing about that. I, along with most of my friends, neighbors, and colleagues here in West Virginia, am relatively happy with life here. Happier, for example, than I was in sophisticated and ectomorphic Boston, Washington, or New York, where I grew up. Or somewhat more mesomorphic and less cheerful Clarksville, Tennessee. And well, as for my health, whatever lacks I am currently experiencing in that domain have more to do with my own negligence than any shortcomings on the part of this wild and wonderful state. Most of my friends and neighbors, in addition, seem in reasonably good physical shape, though I'd be the last to deny that West Virginia, along with the other 8 American states I've resided in, has more than its share of people who are overweight and more than its fair share of bad teeth. I've lived in Virginia only a scant 5 years, but I've already grown more than a bit tired of having the place I've chosen to live and maybe even die in constantly maligned and belittled by our superior-feeling fellow citizens and journalists in New York, Massachusetts, Washington, and California, to name but a few. To my mind, at least, the people depicted in the condescending documentary The Wild Wonderful Whites of West Virginia are no more representative of our state than is Bernie Madoff of New York, or the brothers Joe Carr and Tamerlan Chernayev are of Massachusetts. The wonderful law school I teach at, insofar as I can tell, is equally good as the far snobbier, higher-rated, and far less cheerful one I myself intended. Our environmental laws may leave something to be desired, but then again, it may be the breathtaking beauty of our state that draws our attention to them. Nor is a West Virginia farmer any more likely to call his sheep darling or marry his cousin than a native New Yorker is to take a chainsaw to a parking meter or cheat on his taxes. Yes, students at WVU seem to have themselves a good time, and probably do a hell of a lot more drinking than teetotalers like myself. But whoever it is that's counting up the party hours or the drinks at U.S. News and World Report might be better off finding a worthier subject for his or her skills than making lists no right-thinking person could care less about. The moral of the story, methinks, is not only that those who can't do sometimes teach, or that those who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, but that those who judge the rest of us according to polls might do better taking a long, hard look at themselves. What they find there, who knows, might take them down a few notches on their polling data, where they will have us happy and healthy West Virginians to keep them company.
Michael Blumenthal is a writer who lives in Morgantown, West Virginia, and is a visiting professor at the West Virginia University College of Law, where he has taught since 2009. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The Academy of Country Music Awards were handed out last Sunday in Nashville. Between 1981 and 1987, Kentucky-born bluegrass musician Ricky Skaggs took home awards for Touring Band of the Year and Specialty Instrument. In 1981, Skaggs was named Top New Male Vocalist, and in 2011, he won the Cliffy Stone Pioneer Award, honoring individuals who are pioneers in country music. At age 7, Skaggs was already performing with the likes of legends such as Bill Monroe and Flatten Scruggs. After more than 50 years, Skaggs has become one of the most recognizable names in the genre and well-respected by his peers. Now at 59, Skaggs has released Kentucky Traveler, My Life in Music, a book detailing his upbringing and his career. While out on the road promoting the book last summer, Skaggs stopped by the Charleston studios of West Virginia Public Broadcasting and sat down with Dave Mistich to discuss the book, his music, and life in Appalachia.
One of the things that I'm absolutely fascinated by is the idea of a sense of place or identity. You know, anyone that would pick up a book or a record by you, it's very distinct that you're from Appalachia.
Yeah.
What is the identity of Appalachia?
Well, you know, my mom was a precious, precious woman. And she grew up hard, worked all of her life. I mean, when she was 4 or 5 years old, she learned how to cook, and she would cook my granddad breakfast before he walked 10 miles to go catch a ride and work on the WPA. And cause her mom was in the bed having babies all the time. So she, with her baby sisters and brothers. So she came up hard, But she taught me when I was young, you know, you are no better than anybody, but you're as good as anybody. And don't you ever be ashamed of where you're from. Don't you ever be ashamed of how you talk. And you're from these woods and these mountains. And I want people to know that that's where you're from, because there's something special about being from here. Everybody's not born here. And yes, ma'am, you know, and I mean, and I took that to heart. And when I wrote this book, Kentucky Traveler, I wanted to make sure that the co-writer, Eddie Dean, that wrote Ralph Stanley's book, I wanted to make sure that they got my voice. They found the rhythm of my voice. They found the sound of my voice. And they found the mountain ease of my voice. Because I ain't changing. I'm proud to be from these mountains. I've never tried to change, you know, the way I talk. I go places and they say, oh, I just love to hear you talk. I love your accent, you know, and thanks, you know. We all talk like that at home, you know. That's just where I'm from and I'm proud of it. Love these mountains.
You've had a long storied career, having been involved, you know, Bill Monroe, Flattened Scruggs. Later in your career, played with guys like, you know, Jerry Douglas, Vela Fleck. I mean, I could name a ton of names and I'd be out of breath at the end of it. Is it possible, looking back on your career, and to pick any handful of moments or any of these musicians that you played with as being more influential than another?
There was an old fiddler in eastern Kentucky named Sanford Kelly. I mean, when I met that guy, it was a defining moment. I mean, it honestly was. I had never really heard old-time mountain fiddling. I'd heard bluegrass, and I'd heard people that played, you know, the Arthur Smith type fiddle playing, you know. But when I heard Sanford Kelly, I gotta say, that guy absolutely blew my mind. And I didn't know how my mind was being blown at the time. I mean, I started playing fiddle when I was about 13. So I've been playing for maybe a couple of years when I met Sanford. But when I heard those minor slides and all that mountain nasty, you know, good old stuff, man, it blew me away. It was like a guy was speaking a foreign language, you know, that I was wanting to know, you know. I wanted to interpret that, you know, and my heart was feeling so full when I heard it. And then the second time he came to the house, he got my banjo. I had a banjo that I was trying to learn to play some Scruggs style banjo on, and played this drop thumb style, clawhammer style banjo. And that then blew my mind even more, you know. And so that guy and his old time fiddle playing and the banjo stuff, I use that style of playing all these years later. I mean, today. That old cat, man, he was like 84, 85 years old when I met him, and he was still killing it, you know. And I'm so thankful to God that man walked into my life, because it changed the way I thought about music.
And give me back to the book. Tell me the reasons for writing it now.
Well, you know, I could easily say I'm not getting any younger, okay, because I'm 59 now, and I started the book 2 years ago. I had an offer from another publisher, a different publisher. HarperCollins has done this one. But a few years back, 10 years ago or so, I had another offer. And it was a good offer, but I don't know. I wasn't ready, I guess, maybe to do a book at the time. I wanted to write it, I think, now because I think I'm at a place in my personal life, my spiritual life, my musical life, that I can tell these stories with conviction. I can tell them in ways that that have, you know, a weighty quality about it. My kids are gone and from home now. It's a little lonesome over at the old Skaggs house, you know, with me and Miss Sharon. But I'm still madly in love with her and chase her around the room tonight. Yeah, that's crazy.
What's your hope whenever people read that book? What do you hope they take away with them?
I hope that they will see that, you know, music is a gift. You don't just wake up someday and think, you know, I think I'd like to learn how to play the the piano or something like that. I think there's a gift, you know, and I believe that all gifts come from God. I just believe that. I believe we're born with it. And if you don't have the gift, you can learn a little bit, but if you don't have the gift, it's just not, you're not going to love it. You're not going to use it. You're not going to really work hard on it. I also believe that this book will encourage people to take the time that you need to learn. I started playing when I was five, and there was a lot of doors open to me when I got to play with Bill Monroe when I was six, and Flatt & Scruggs at seven, and the Stanley Brothers right after that. I got to play with those heroes, yes. But I worked a long time on the instruments. I would play mandolin, then I went to guitar, and then I went to fiddle, and then I went to banjo. But I would never leave something completely alone. So I think, the faith that I have in Christ, that I learned from my parents, learned in church, has really kept me grounded. I think that is a great thing that they can learn from this book. But just faith, family, and music, and those three things that shaped my life, I think there's a lot in this book to learn about all three of those things.
Well, thanks so much, Ricky. Greatly appreciate it.
Yes, sir, man.
When Ralph Peer held recording sessions for Victor Records in the state line town of Bristol, Tennessee, Virginia in 1927, he discovered the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers and essentially started the country music industry. Columbia Records wanted to get in on the Appalachian field recording business, so in 1928, they sent one of their top producers to nearby Johnson City. A CD box set and book featuring the Johnson City Sessions was released last December. Wayne Winkler from WETS reports.
Frank Buckley Walker had signed Bessie Smith to Columbia Records and was responsible for the first commercial recordings of Cajun music, but early country music was his specialty. He recorded Charlie Poole and his North Carolina Ramblers, Gid Tanner and Riley Puckett in New York. He did some recording in Atlanta, but Ralph Peer's successful recordings in Bristol inspired Walker and Columbia to try field recording in the same general area. So in October of 1928, Walker placed an ad in a Johnson City, Tennessee newspaper with the headline, "Can You Sing or Play Old-Time Music?" That was how he set up the first of what became known as the Johnson City Sessions. 85 years later, the music Frank Walker recorded is being released in a 4-CD box set by Bear Family Records of Hamburg, Germany. Ted Olson of East Tennessee State University's Department of Appalachian Studies, who initiated and produced the Bristol Sessions, has done the same for the lesser-known Johnson City recordings. As with the Bristol set, he and British country music scholar Tony Russell have composed a lavish 136-page book detailing every aspect of the sessions, including photographs, biographies of the performers, a day-by-day session log, lyric sheets, and discographies.
Once the Bristol Sessions box set was put out in 2011 by the Bear Family Records label out of Germany, that same label took an interest, after I had a long conversation with them, in releasing this rest of the story, the Johnson City Sessions. And so for the last, say, 15 months, my colleague on the project, Tony Russell, who's based in England, who's a country music scholar, we basically brought this story out of obscurity because there hadn't been much research conducted. We really had to get creative to find out who these people were and where they came from, why they came to Johnson City. How did their records sell? What were the rest of their creative lives like? Did they continue to play music after they kind of disappeared into obscurity?
Have you heard the many stories told by old and young with joys of the many deeds of daring that were done by the Johnson boys?
Hop up, pretty girls, don't be afraid. Hop up, pretty girls, don't be afraid. Hop up, pretty girls, don't be afraid. Hop up, pretty girls, don't be afraid.
Some of the performers at the Johnson City Sessions had recorded for Ralph Peer at the Bristol Sessions. The Grant brothers, Jack and Claude, had, along with Jack Pierce, been Jimmy Rogers' backing band, but Peer separated them and recorded the band as the Tenever Ramblers. Frank Walker recorded Jack and Claude Grant, Pierce and Claude Slagle as the Grant brothers, but other acts didn't have nearly as much recording experience.
One such group was the Motesville String Ticklers from West Virginia.
There were 8 musicians in the band, and they all came down, according to the stories that the family tell, in the back of 2 cars with the instruments placed into pillowcases because they could not afford actual instrument cases. They made 2 recordings here, are their only recordings that we have of this band. The one known as West Virginia Hills is considered the definitive recording of the West Virginia state song. It's a much prized recording that far too few people have ever heard.
Oh, the West Virginia hills, how unchanged they seem to stand, with their summits pointed skyward to the great almighty's land. Many changes I can see, which my heart with sadness filled, but no changes can be noticed in those West Virginia hills. Oh, the hills, beautiful hills,
beautiful hills,
how I love the West Virginia hills. Your land I roam, still I think of happy home and the friends among the West Virginia hills.
When Frank Walker returned to Johnson City in October of 1929, he recorded some of the most memorable songs of the Johnson City sessions, including this one from an obscure group from North Carolina called the Bentley Boys, Down on Penny's Farm.
First of all, people probably have heard it before, perhaps in the context of the Harry Smith Anthology of American Folk Music, which is a legendary album that was released in the 50s that's credited with launching the urban folk revival of the 50s and 60s.
Come here, ladies and gentlemen, listen to the song. Sang it to you right, but you might think it's wrong. May make you mad, but I mean no harm. It's just about to run his own Penny's farm. It's a hard times in the country, out on Penny's farm. You move out on Penny's farm, plant a little crop of bagger and a little crop of corn. Come around and see you gonna flit and flot till you get yourself a mortgage on everything you got. It's a hard times in the country, out on Penny's farm.
This song has inspired a lot of musicians over the years. Bob Dylan, for example, dedicated not one song, but 2 songs to his love for this particular song.
Come here, ladies and gentlemen, and listen to my song. Sing it to you right, but you might think it's wrong. Just a little glimpse of a star out of town about an East Coast city that you all know well. It's hard times from the country living down in New York town. Oh, New York.
The second of 2 Bob Dylan songs inspired by the Bentley Boys Down on Penny's Farm, recorded in Johnson City, Tennessee in 1929.
One of the most famous people who came to Johnson City for the Johnson City sessions was Clarence Ashley. Clarence Ashley is a legendary musician who, in fact, is credited with having introduced the world to Doc Watson. Mm-hmm. Because Clarence Ashley recommended that Ralph Rinsler, who is affiliated with the Smithsonian, to come down to make a record of Doc Watson in the early 60s. And then, of course, Doc took off from there. But Clarence was famous in his own right with this marvelous voice, very high-pitched and mournful, and this unique frailing banjo style.
Oh, the cuckoo is a pretty bird. She wobbles as she flies, she never hollers cuckoo till the 4th day July. I've played cards in Dingbong, I've played cards in Spain. I'll bet you $10 I beat you next game.
Olson and co-writer Tony Russell were nominated for a Grammy Award for the book that accompanied the Bristol Sessions box set. The book accompanying the Johnson City box set is even more extensive and represents a tougher job tracking down information.
We had to work through secondary sources, namely family members who remembered people. And to find these people wasn't easy, but the way we did it was we put ads and articles in local papers all over the Appalachian area in eastern Kentucky, western North Carolina, and, of course, East Tennessee. And lo and behold, people started calling us and writing us from out of the blue saying, we saw this article in the paper and we'd like to tell you about our ancestors who played at the Johnson City Sessions. So Tony Russell and I just started to gather the stories over the last 15 months based on this very rudimentary technique of getting the word out. And We were able to get some wonderful stories.
But unfortunately for some of the performers at the original sessions, many of the records didn't sell well. Some were never even released, because the final day of the 1929 sessions coincided with the first day of the stock market crash. That's one reason the Johnson City sessions were not as well known as those that took place up the road in Bristol. But Ted Olson contends that the Johnson City sessions have their own special place in music history.
It may not have the kind of overarching impact of the Bristol Sessions box set. I mean, after all, people have been calling the Bristol Sessions the Big Bang of country music for some years now. There's no comparable statement you can make about the Johnson City Sessions in the respect that they didn't necessarily create a genre almost, you know, single-handedly. We don't make any such claims for the Johnson City Sessions. The Johnson City Sessions, in my opinion, are very important because they show Appalachian music in the widest possible variety at the cusp of the Great Depression. And I think that's important because really the music that sold during the Great Depression tended to be more commercial music. The music on the Johnson City Sessions is kind of that last bastion of traditional music finding voice in a mass media environment. Three of the strongest records on the Anthology of American Folk Music were recorded in Johnson City in 1928 and 1929. It's a quieter story. It's a story that gets has gotten a lot less attention than the Bristol Sessions. But it's a story whose time has come.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Wayne Winkler in Johnson City, Tennessee.
Going back to Johnson City, I'll go back and stay someday.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Kentucky Poet Laureate Frank X. Walker received the 2014 NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Literary Work in Poetry for Turn Me Loose, The Unghosting of Medgar Evers. The book is a collection of poems that verbalize the emotions of those who knew Evers at the time of his assassination in 1963. Walker, who is director of the African American and Africana Studies Program at the University of Kentucky, was the Appalachian Writer in Residence at Shepherd University during last fall's Appalachian Heritage Festival, where he took time to talk with me about his own career as a writer and artist activist. Why do you do poetry versus other types of writing?
Well, that's the myth about me. People know about my poetry, but I'm trained as a fiction writer. I spent 10 years as a playwright. My first real job out of college was as a journalist. I don't think of myself as a poet. I think of myself as a writer, and I'd like to think I'm competent in more than one genre. I've finished a novel, which I hope will be in bookstores in the next few years, but I've had more success as a poet, admittedly.
What is it about poetry that attracted you to make that a primary form of communication?
Well, I think that what happened with me in poetry has more to do with, as my life became more complicated, as far as how much time I had to spend on certain kinds of things. You know, I was a young parent, working multiple jobs to feed my daughter and to take care of myself and to pay for school. That didn't leave me a lot of time to write. And I had to travel a lot, which makes it difficult to write larger things like fiction. But I can write a poem on an airplane or driving down 64 from Lexington to Louisville. I can write a poem in a hotel room anywhere, but I can't write anything bigger than that in any of those spaces. So I think that, you know, my productivity as a poet is just a function and byproduct of how limited my time has been.
So you have become more a poet by necessity?
Yeah, I think as an artist, you have to create something. You need that sense of satisfaction to make sure that you actually are an artist. You need some evidence of your artistry. And, you know, if I just looked at my failed fiction projects, I'd probably feel like a failure. But I can look at successful poems that appeared in journals and anthologies, and then the collections that the poems appeared in, and feel like, okay, I'm producing art, so I'm an artist, I'm a writer.
Well, one of the things I find interesting about your poetry is that a lot of your books, when you pick them up, are not just books of random poetry. They are almost novels in poetry form. You have the historical poetry novel books. Talk a little bit about what led you to approach poetry that way.
Well, you know, I think that if I wasn't an English teacher, I'd teach history. And I think that, you know, whatever we bring to the page is a byproduct of who we are in the real world. And my love for history has found its way into my writing. But I'm particularly drawn to historical subjects that have been told incorrectly or have been told, and in that telling, it rendered individuals or people invisible. So I'm working against that invisibility. The Lewis and Clark book was important to me because I got to tell it from the point of view of York. Most people who know Lewis and Clark don't know the story of York, and I think it's an incomplete story if you take York out of it, or York's enslaved wife, or Native Americans in general. And so I had a chance to erase some of that invisibility with those two books. The same thing with Isaac Murphy. You know, I got to tell the story of the true history of thoroughbred racing, at least in Kentucky and in the region. A lot of people see the current version of the Kentucky Derby and don't know how it started, how different that reality is. So part of my job as an artist activist is to do that. The latest book that has historical ties is about Medgar Evers, and, you know, young people don't seem to know who he is, and they haven't been taught a broad enough civil rights era story that it includes Medgar Evers. So I'm trying to make him, you know, the title's called Unghosting of Medgar Evers. So I'm trying to bring him back into the conversation. So it's not just history, it's those people whose historical importance have been erased.
One of the things you focused on in your career is making people realize that Appalachia isn't just a white place. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about what African Americans have brought in culture and art to the region.
Well, that's always an easy response for me, and it's really hard to imagine how the caricatures and stereotypes of Appalachia have survived so well in the face of the hard evidence that puts people like Carter G. Woodson, who's the father of African-American history, in the middle of that equation, and puts Nina Simone and Bill Withers and Roberta Flack and Skip Gates and Negro League Baseball and August Wilson and all his African-American theater. You know, if you add all those, you know, to those hollow negative stereotypes like Little Abner and Snuffy Smith, it changes the equation. And I think the challenge is, when people talk about the region, is to first not see it as homogeneous and all white, and to acknowledge that it's broad enough to include a Birmingham and a Pittsburgh, that is both rural and urban. And only then will we be able to shake away from those hard and false stereotypes and caricatures that are still pervasive. And it's a shame. And I think it's the only people who can do it are people who live in this space and work in this space. The outsiders are not going to do it because I think they still enjoy the power of having somebody to laugh at. But they're laughing at something that's not true.
Why do you think it's important to dispel the myth?
Well, because I think that anywhere there are negative caricatures and stereotypes of people, they should be done away with. And I think it's, you know, the you know, the self-respect and attitudes of the children who live here. You know, they need to not believe that those things are about them. They need to know those things are false. They need to know that they have value and worth, and, you know, they can project themselves into spaces in the world that may not seem available if they believe those negative stereotypes and limitations. If for no other reason, you know, just for the children, you know, and because it's a lie, you know, that's the big thing.
You are an Appalachian writer, so what is your contribution, do you think, to the literary works of Appalachia?
Well, I would say my contributions include forcing a discussion of the true diversity of the region. I would say my contributions include getting people to recommit to poetry, I think, to kind of erase this myth about poetry not belonging to everybody. You know, part of my work is missionary work. I'm trying to recruit new fans of poetry, people who not just appreciate poetry, but recognize that they need some and want some of that in their life. And as a teacher of young writers and artists, I think that, you know, my contribution is teaching and educating the next generation of artists and writers from the region.
Well, Frank X. Walker, Poet Laureate of Kentucky, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. There are about 5,000 members of the Future Farmers of America in the state of West Virginia and almost 600,000 across the country. One of the organization's leaders is a young man from Point Pleasant who is the first national officer from West Virginia in 40 years. West Virginia Public Radio's Glennis Board caught up with him recently and brings us this report.
Meet Wesley Davis. He goes by Wes. He's 19, and this guy has a story. He grew up in Point Pleasant around lots of agriculture. He also spent a lot of time with his grandmother, who has an entrepreneur's spirit. For years, he worked at her flag store. One way or another, he inherited that spirit because by the seventh grade, his wheels started turning after a bunny mishap.
And I had thought that we had gotten two females, but ended up we had a male and a female. And of course, you know what rabbits do. They have a lot of babies. So they had a litter of babies, and I had about 10 rabbits. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to go into the rabbit business. I'm going to start selling these things and make millions of dollars, you know. By the time I sold all these rabbits, my mom and dad were like, absolutely not. We're not getting any more of these rabbits. It's just not happening.
But Wes wasn't convinced his parents appreciated the possibilities. So he bided his time and looked for different avenues of approach. The county fair was, of course, the next day.
So I start into the fairgrounds, and the first place I go, I dash to the rabbit and poultry barn and start looking around. And, of course, there's rabbits for sale, and I find this one in the back corner. It's got, like, these, you know, beautiful little lop ears, and I'm thinking, I'm going to buy this rabbit.
His mother had different ideas. He pleaded and argued and pointed out all the cuteness, to which she replied,
it's not happening. You're not bringing home anything with heartbeat except for your brother. It's just not happening.
This is when Wes got his brother involved. By the end of the week, all prices reduced. $5 rabbit, now $3. Wes approached his little brother, who he knew would do anything for him.
I asked him, I was like, Zach, can I have $3 to get a drink? And he's like, Well, yeah, sure. So he gives me the $3. I go running towards the rabbit and poultry barn and find this rabbit in the cage. I'm like, yes, I'm finally going to get this rabbit. And as I go to get it, I look on the cage, and where it had said $3, it had a big X through it, and it said sold. And so I was so disappointed. Like, this rabbit, I wanted this thing all week long, and they already sold my rabbit. So, I head socking, just walking around. I went over to the poultry side of the barn and started looking around, and I found this chicken for $1. I'm thinking, I can get the chicken, I can get the drink. I didn't technically lie to him.
So that's what he did. He bought the chicken, he bought the drink, and he endured the wrath of his mother. That's how Wes found his chicken. From there, it's history. Wes was in the egg business.
So I ended up growing it, and by the time I was a senior in high school, I had 350 birds. I was selling to 100 schools, or 100 homes, 9 schools, and 10 restaurants. Also had a compost operation, so all the litter from the poultry themselves, it actually was composted, so that was a third of the revenue in itself. So it wasn't just selling the eggs from the birds, it was also selling the compost.
Wes made $45,000 in revenue his senior year on 2 acres. With some help from the USDA in the form of a $5,000 young farmer loan, he bought his first brooding house to start a group of chickens, and he soon had 50, then 350 birds. The USDA also offers grants through what's called the Natural Resources Conservation Service.
They basically look at how can we protect the environment with agriculture and partner them together. So I actually got a grant to construct that composting facility. So the thing was is that a lot of people see, poultry waste as waste, something that you throw away. But the thing was I could get this grant where I had absolutely no investment in this facility, then take that litter, process it into a product, and sell it.
Wes explains that it all folded back into making himself marketable. He tapped into the local food market, and when people found out his was an environmentally responsible business, they were even more likely to support him. Now he's touring the country and even making trips abroad as a national officer of the FFA, the first from West Virginia in almost 40 years. Wes attributes a lot of his success to the training and encouragement he got through the FFA. He's been visiting industry partners and officials, but the next 8 months will be dedicated to what he calls a marathon of classrooms and state FFA conventions and meeting with state and local leaders. Wes is also enrolled at West Virginia University studying agribusiness management and agriculture education. He says after his year as an FFA officer, he'll start his own personal quest for meaning. He has big ideas about ways to improve his home state, and he wants to see more successful businesses diversify West Virginia's economy. He's developing those ideas and obviously becoming an effective communicator. He talks about the 3 P's of successful business: product, people, and process.
In West Virginia, we have excellent people. Like, our people are just awesome. Like, and I go around the country and I see a lot of different places, but the people from West Virginia are just different. They want to help you. They are encouraging. They'll work as hard as they need to get the job done. And that's really, really inspiring in itself. It's the process in West Virginia that I think that we're lacking a lot of times. We have great products, so great ideas for products and services. So I want to one day come back and help develop that process and see how is it that we can continue to have success, not only in entrepreneurship, but in education, in our government, and in the things that really help to advance our state.
Wes doesn't have a clear idea of what or where he'll end up next. All he knows for sure is that he wants to do something helpful in the world.
Because I really think that we're meant to help other people any way that we can. So be it if I'm in business or if I'm in education or wherever I am, I want it to be something where I'm helping people.
3 cheers for future farmers, right? For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.